Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Hello? Hello? We're almost there. All right. Hey, long time no hear.
Yeah, how you doing?
Doing well. Super excited to hear you again.
Yeah, I'm alive. That's about it.
Oh, man, I hear you.
Yeah, we're a couple minutes early yet anyway, so...
Well, I'm going to start recording about 30 seconds. No, actually, right now.
Okay.
And good evening, everyone. Welcome to a special edition Thursday night here, Wednesday night, excuse me, here at Your Remedy is in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're pleased to bring back an information provider from some of our past shows, returning again, very excited, on the subject of credit cards, Mr. Michael Maris. My name is Martin. I'll be your host for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedy is in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer. Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedy is in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do were they similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless. And it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedies in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com, if we look up in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure, better known to some as American jurisprudence or AMJUR. The rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on and virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes a lot of the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course, so it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known majorly for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very affordably priced, the jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of your remedies in the law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of yourremediesinthelaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups at Your Remedy is in the Law. And Your Remedy is in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that altogether make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at yourremediesinthelaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict, pre-decided topics of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you'll get to a point where it will ask you, what are your hot points? What are you interested in? This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights. Anything that you can think of. And if it affects your personal rights in one way or another, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much of how you think of a social network, though nothing like a social network. It's very custom. It's very private. But it then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be of a tremendous amount of help to you. Well, maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do were I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look up these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. I mean, for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to a point where you've educated yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people to start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedoms Radio. If you're over the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, maybe you're just new to your remedies in the law and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button. Fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. But every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you don't get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedoms Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make at Your Remedy is in the Law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Edward for advertising at Your Remedy is in the Law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that honestly most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. And we make those introductions. Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. Everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best. And believe you me, we aim for the best. But unavoidable things do sometimes happen, and when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. Again, we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have had to say about these products and services. Now let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not at Your Remedy is in the Law anyway. Of course, when you come aboard and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right. Lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedy is in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if a question is posed properly and then answered properly, then we can all learn something from it.
Thank you, Martin, for your disclaimer. It is greatly and sincerely appreciated. Ladies and gentlemen, I am offended by something that I call a sizzle call For any of you that have been in any of the MLMs of years past, Amway, whatever it is, whatever the thing is, they always have these sizzle calls where they talk about, you know, the successes of this and the successes of that. Well, buckle up, because I'm going to give you not a sizzle call, but a sizzle moment. We're so excited to announce one of the team's students was facing 12 years in prison. The gentleman is nearly my age, and I've been here 70 years. I'm starting my 71st in the spring. To ease his physical suffering, he finds comfort and relief in the CBD gummy bears, or whatever they're called. He purchased lawfully out of California, whatever the packages were. He had 8 or 10 of them, 12 of them, whatever, bought a small case of it, and was traveling back to Arizona, I think is what it was. Maybe Colorado. I don't remember. But anyways, point being is he was pulled over again for something ridiculous, like a taillight being out, and would love to see the dash cam to make sure that taillight was actually out. And the officer arrested him and took him into custody because he had gummy bears. They weren't even opened. And so this has been going on now for 8 months or so. And just today, we received a copy of the prosecutor's motion to dismiss with prejudice. And that's success. 12 years was what he was facing. And you have to understand, it is so incredibly profitable to imprison you. That's BOP, the Bureau of Prisons, their budget is over $1.5 billion a year. There's a tremendous amount of money to be made by putting you in jail. And the work that the team put together in assisting to teach this gentleman how they would answer something, how they would do something, were they similarly situated? And I'm just so excited about this outcome. So that's the extent of my sizzle tonight. I'm glad to share with you that we have Mr. Slevin with us this evening. And again, Mr. Slevin's product, his LLC, is so incredibly unique and positions you on its face to deal with your tax situation, i.e. to remove it from the table, as well as enabling you to plug in at a later time into what Justice Beshear refers to as the golden horseshoe. So without further ado, it's my pleasure to turn this call over to Mr. Slevin.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen.
Hey, handsome.
Michael,
how was your week?
Very well, thank you. It was good here, and we had a good time. Just a comment on that, the profitability of the prison system. There's this thing called the CRIS, which is a court registry investment system. It's what Congress handed to the federal judiciary to make it worth their while to make sure as many people get into the prison system as possible. It operates on bonds. And so when somebody is charged with, we'll say, a 10-year sentence, there's a bond created, and it's marketed through the CRIS worldwide. Now, the people that manage the CRIS are bankers, such as Lehman Brothers, at one time Bear Stearns, and so forth. These people take these bonds and market them, and we'll say, for example, it was a 10-year bond at $10 million at 10%. And so somebody in Zimbabwe has got $10 million, and he'd like to get 10%, so he hands over the cash to the CRIS, and then the CRIS reinvests that. And then at the end of the term, the bond holder then in Zimbabwe then receives back his money plus interest. I have seen the paperwork. That interest, first of all, let me say the bond is secured by the human body in the prison system. the federal prison system. And that interest is paid by the Social Security account of the that it was assigned to the human upon the application of the SS-5. Just thought you might want to look that up. And we'll now continue on into our really great explanation of how you can protect yourself and protect your stuff, because that's the two main things that you've got in this world, right? So the organic document of the country, of this country, is the Declaration of Independence, published 1776. And this is probably the most often quoted and the most important piece of it. Quote, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights," "that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." Pause there. Pursuit of happiness was done because they felt that property was too confining. And, of course, in order to have life, you must have property, such as your food and water, in order to continue that life, and got to have something to keep you warm and so on and so forth. All this is property. And so exercising life, liberty, right to property equals the pursuit of happiness. To continue. "That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundations on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness," end quote. So, folks, I suggest everyone's like, just go read the whole Declaration of Independence and see that the time and effort that was taken before hostilities were commenced. Because that declaration is a work of reason. Now, reason with a capital R, it's an extraordinary process of moving from point A to point B in a logical progression and to overcome an obstacle or fix something. And it was actually ordained by God. In Isaiah 1:18, it says, quote, "Come now, let us reason together, says the Lord. Though your sins are like scarlet, they shall be as white as snow. Though they are red like crimson, they shall become like wool," end quote. Now, these words are a fantastic visual of the process of setting what is perceived to be a wrong to everything being right. So after we declared our independence from England, the monarchy thereof, the sovereignty of that construct devolved upon each of the we the people. From Chisholm v. Georgia in 1793 at page 471, quote, "The same feudal ideas run through all of their jurisprudence." Now, this is the jurisprudence of Europe and the princes and things. "And constantly reminds us of the distinction between the prince and the subject. No such idea obtains here in the New World. At the Revolution, the sovereignty devolved on the people, and they are truly the sovereigns of the country, but they are sovereigns without subjects, unless the African slaves among us may be called so," "and have none to govern but themselves. The citizens of America are equal as fellow citizens and as joint tenants in the sovereignty." So when you hear people in Washington or whatever state capital you happen to be in referred to as our leaders, they are not. They are equal to us, but they are our representatives in that form of government called the Constitutional Republic, of, under which we stand. So the quote from Chisholm v. Georgia is plain. We are each a sovereign. We are truly free man. And we use capital M for man and men to support that we are each part of mankind, having a womb or not. So we each own ourselves, our bodies, and the production thereof, we are absolutely entitled or endowed or granted and presented with all of that. It belongs to us. We hold title. And that would be called allodial title, as in no other person having any claim upon it. So the freedom and the liberty that we are given, and it bears great responsibility. Because if you have this, if you own everything about you, your body, your production, your time, it must be considered, because that has exceptional value. And if you don't consider the agreements or the contracts that you make with other men, then you can easily be tricked into giving that away for mere promises. And one of these promises is security. Like, anybody ever heard of Social Security? So we must remember the wise Benjamin Franklin, who said, or once wrote rather, those who would give up essential liberty to purchase a little temporary safety deserve neither liberty nor safety, because they're not aware of the value that they have been presented. So I would suggest that you take a minute and run over and look at Genesis 25, 29 through 34, where Esau sold his birthright to his brother for a bowl of porridge. It's a pitiful story that somebody who is so robust could devalue something like the birthright of Abraham for a bowl of porridge. Pathetic. Let's take a minute to look at that parenthetical comment in Chisholm about the African slaves. Now, it appears that SCOTUS left the Negro out in the cold, and the Constitution actually did address slavery. Of course, the Constitution was only just a few years before Chisholm. And it says in Article 1, Section 9 of Clause 1, it says, quote, the migration or importation of such persons, that being black persons, as any of the states now existing shall think proper to admit, shall not be prohibited by Congress prior to the year 1808, but a tax or duty may be imposed upon such importation, not exceeding $10 per each person. So $10 in 1800 was roughly $10,000 today. Probably a little more, but we'll go with round numbers on that one. So the codification by Congress of this constitutional section says was the Act of Prohibiting Importation of Slaves in 1807. So this act, quote, this act is a United States federal law that provided that no new slaves were permitted to be imported into the United States. It took effect on January 1, 1808, which is the earliest date permitted by the United States Constitution. However, that did not change the things on the ground, as we say, in the several states and territories that existed at that point in time. So there was a great expansion of the United States of America during the 1800s. Of course, I believe it was 1822 was those two explorers that I'll think about later, the Louisiana Purchase and so forth. So you had all these territories out there, and some of them were free, some of them were slaves, and so on and so forth. So there was a guy named Dred Scott, who was a slave of Dr. Sanford, who was a military officer, and he was given a wife, of which they had two daughters, and he was carried around into several slave and free areas in Missouri, Kansas, and so forth. And then the slave owner, Dr. Sanford, took his wife and daughters and sold them. And he tried to sue to get remedy in the what was called at that time called the Circuit Courts of the United States, according to I believe it was 1792 Judiciary Act, called them the District Courts of the United States. So it came to be called the Dred Scott v. Sanford or Dred v. Sanford case in 1856. And something like 250 pages, which is the longest one, longest Supreme Court decision written to date. And if you ever have trouble falling asleep, try reading it. I guarantee you won't have any insomnia. So the court ruled against Dred in this, and all of the justices weighed in. And Justice Daniel did something rather interesting. He first states, quote, "This was an action of trespass vi et armis instituted in the Circuit Court of the United States for the District of Missouri in the name of the plaintiff in error, a Negro held as a slave for the recovery of freedom for himself, his wife, two children, also Negroes." And so then, as end quote. But then Justice Daniel brought forward the writings of Justinian, who was a 6th century Roman emperor. And he said, they said at page 479, quote, "The above account of slavery and its modification will be found in the strictest conformity with the institutes of Justinian. Thus, in the first book, third title, it said, quote, the first general division of persons in respect to their rights is into free men and slaves. The same title, end quote. The same title, see section 4, quote, slaves are born such or become so. They are born such of bond women." Remember that. "They become so either by the law of nations, as by capture, or by civil law." Section 5. "In the condition of slaves, there is no diversity." If you're a slave, you're just a slave. That's all it is. To continue. "But among free persons, there are many. Thus, some are ingenii, or free men, and others are libertini, or freed men. In the fourth degeneris, a free man is one who is born free by being born in matrimony of parents both who both are free or both freed, or of parents one free and the other freed, but one born of a free mother, although the father be a slave or unknown, is free." So everything comes through the mother. And this is, yes, you go, hey, but that's Roman law. Exactly. And if you look at American law, Roman law is instilled in every possible corner of this country, unfortunately. So everything comes to the mother. And to continue, the 13th Amendment, which was ratified in 1865, right at the end of the Civil War, the War of Northern Aggression. It says, that 13th Amendment says, "Neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as for punishment of a crime, whereof, the party shall have been duly convicted, shall exist within the United States or any place subject to their jurisdiction," end quote. So, because the bond of all women, both Negro and others similarly situated, was extinguished by that 13th Amendment, then every body born in America after December 6, 1865 was in fact a free man. There are no more slaves. Just as a little quote though, that 13th Amendment was presumably the second one. And this, the following can be found in the New Hampshire House Bill 638 of the 2013 session. It says, quote, "In 1810, a proposed amendment to the United States Constitution, which prohibited titles of nobility and which later became known as the original 13th Amendment, was introduced, passed both houses of Congress, and was sent off to the states for ratification. On December 9, 1812, shortly after ratification by Virginia, New Hampshire became the 13th state to ratify the amendment. The amendment was therefore ratified by the requisite number of states and became Article 13 of the United States Constitution. This article reads, if any citizen of the United States shall accept, claim, receive, or retain any title of nobility or honor, or shall, without the consent of Congress, accept and retain any present, pension, office, or emolument of any kind whatever from any emperor, king, prince, or foreign power, such person shall cease to be a citizen of the United States and shall be incapable of holding any office of trust or profit under them or either of them, being the several states. Now, this 13th Amendment was probably one of the reasons because title of nobility, one of those titles is Esquire. And so what do we refer to attorneys as? And this possibly was one of the reasons that Washington City was burned by the British in 1814. And I think there were some other financial interests we may get into at a later date. The foregoing, that little blurb there was just to show you a little bit about how things have been rewritten in history and how you've been a little bit more lied to. So jumping back to the 1865 version of the 13th Amendment, it outlaws slavery. But remember it said, too, that you couldn't have involuntary servitude. But earlier we talked about being able to trade off our liberty, our property, our bodies for security or service or safety. So you can, in fact, contract for servitude. And guess what? Somebody up in D.C. set that up for you. So after the 13th law outlawing slavery was done, then they came along with the 14th Amendment because there was a lot of reason for that. One of the main reasons quoted, of course, was that the Negro was not being treated well back in the South where they most of them, the greater part of them lived at that point. So, but what the 14th Amendment actually did was create a form of servitude. That servant is called a United States lowercase c citizen. And the Slaughterhouse Cases of 1872, I believe, sets that up and refers to the United States lowercase c citizen and a Union State citizen. Union State citizens is now what we know is known as the American national. Now, the way that a person today gets into that voluntary servitude is via the certification of the birth record and the application for Social Security account. And as I mentioned prior, that Social Security account is not just for your old age benefits. So, all that being said, we know for certain that most Americans are slaves of the District of Columbia. And so knowing that, I highly, highly suggest that you get a hold of GW and get that process to move back to the sovereignty of we the people as stated in Georgia. By doing that, you protect yourself, and then the loved ones can be clustered in there. And then being that yourself is protected, now we'd like to go on about how do you protect your stuff? Because even though you return to the original we the people sovereignty known as American National, you can still be sued. And if there is a judgment found against you, if your property, your stuff is not properly protected, then guess what? Somebody else is going to have it. So let's go back to the Constitution again. The Constitution of the United States was ratified June 21st of 1788. And in December 15th of 1791, the Bill of Rights, which is the first 10 amendments of the United States Constitution, was ratified. Now, this document should have been called the Bill of Restrictions. Because look at it. I mean, it says like, we'll take the Second Amendment because that's one of my favorites. And it says the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Paraphrasing. So let's examine that word infringed. All right. I'm sure you've all seen the American flag with a gold fringe around it, which is not the United States of America flag as done in, I believe it's Title II of the United States Code or described but it is a military flag, also known as Admiralty. Anyway, it's got this gold fringe around it, and it's got a whole bunch of little bitty gold threads. So to not infringe upon, we'll say that fringe is the right of the people to keep and bear arms. So that word infringe means to not even pull one of those thousands and thousands of threads off of that fringe around the flag. That's what the word infringe means. And so when you get all these clowns in various governments saying, well, yeah, you can carry a gun, but you got to pass this test and get this due and pay this fee and lot, lot, lot. No, wrong answer. That word infringe is rock solid. They shall not do that. So therefore, noting that in the other amendments, it should all be the bill of restrictions. Now, that set up the original government. Of course, the Articles of Confederation was prior to that. So this supplanted it. Some people say the Articles of Confederation were never taken out of effect, so they still have some application. That's a discussion for another day. So it set up the original government in 1788. Now in 1871, we have the District of Columbia Organic Act. Now, this was an act of Congress that repealed the individual charters of the cities of Washington and Georgetown, which were within the 10-mile square District of Columbia, and established a new territorial government for the whole of the District of Columbia. Some say also in that time frame that D.C. became a corporation, and it's argued as to whether it was via the City of London or via the State of Delaware, and some other things have been also offered. Nonetheless, this corporation status is apparently backed up by the United States Code in Title 28, rather, of the United States Code, Section 3002. As used in this Chapter 15, the United States means a federal corporation. So that's some things in there, other indications that that's also true. But what we know for a fact is that D.C. became a city-state at that point. Now, a city-state is entirely independent of anything around it or located near it. And so D.C. is a 10-square-mile up there between Virginia and Maryland and so forth. And the other city-states are the City of London, which is a 1-square-mile enclave in Greater London, U.K., as well as Vatican City, which is a 110-acre parcel near the center of Rome, Italy. Now, these three city-states comprise the military, which is D.C., the financial, which is the City of London, and the ecumenical power center of the earth. Now, the folks that live there and are in the know, they truly believe that they own everything and everybody on the globe. So, and they're pretty vehement about enforcing that. So just to provide us a little bit of evidence to how D.C. became a city-state, we know that they started acquiring foreign property. Now, in 1898, the Spanish-American War broke out, and the use of Pearl Harbor in the Hawaiian Islands grew to a great importance. So D.C. acquired the islands as a territory from Stanford B. Dole of Dole Pineapple, who had stolen it from Queen Liliuokalani in 1893. With the assistance of about 300 U.S. Marines. So as a result of the Spanish-American War, D.C. also acquired the properties of Cuba, Guam, the Philippines, and Puerto Rico. Now, Cuba was supposedly set free, but it was basically a haven for gangsters. And because of the loose nature of it, you had the Castro Revolution 1950s, and the people of Cuba are still suffering from that travesty. The Philippines escaped D.C. in 1946. That place is still a mess. Guam and Puerto Rico remain territories. Now, in Puerto Rico, there's some interesting agencies. The IRS, or Internal Revenue Service, or a friend of mine calls it, it's really Satan, has its headquarters in Puerto Rico. And this is all backed up by citations of particular legislation. So D.C. became the city-state. It also adopted a constitution. Now, this constitution looks very much like the constitution for the United States that was approved in 1788, but for one little word. The document adopted by D.C. is the Constitution of the United States. And almost universally, when you hear the talking heads speaking of the Constitution, they always say the Constitution of the United States. So to understand the difference in these two little words, we go to Wikipedia. It says, quote, two of the most commonly used prepositions are of and for. These two, like all other prepositions, indicate a relationship between the objects in the particular sentence. Of is considered an old English preposition. It means away or away from. The preposition for, on the other hand, initially comes from before, which also means on account of. Therefore, the city-state of D.C. can be seen as being away from or without the Union, called the United States of America. So we've thrown a lot of words out at you in the first portion of this presentation. So this is these machinations, if you will, come at the hands of lexicographers, which we use lexicos for short, and or otherwise known as legislative draftsmen. Now, these people are wordsmiths to the nth degree. And the Supreme Court had a little bit to say about them in a case called Merchants Loan and Trust Company v. Simpanka. In 1921, it says at 28, quote, in determining the definition of the word income thus arrived at, this court has consistently refused to enter into the refinements of lexicographers or economists and has approved in the definition quoted what is believed to be the commonly understood meaning of the term, which must have been in the minds of the people when they adopted the 16th Amendment to the Constitution. See how that the court talks, you know, basically it, in lawyerly language there, it calls lexicographers smarmy buggers. And now, and of course, it also said it was clairvoyant because it knew what must be in the minds of the people, right? So these lexicos do these transmutations of words, and there has come about a way to measure this. It's called the Flesch Index. That's spelled F-L-E-S-C-H. It runs from 1 to 100, and it is a measure of the of understanding of the English language. So it, some examples are a newspaper, typically one you pick up on the corner, is written at 8.5. A first-year college student understands around 11, and a law school graduate comprehends all the way up at 15. So the tax code is written at an average of 33 with pieces as high as 55. If that doesn't shock you, okay. But they have no intention of telling you exactly what they mean. If they were just be honest, things would go much better. Of course, then they wouldn't reap in a river of money every year either. So we're talking about taxing statements. In order to be legitimate, a taxing statute must have these three particulars: the subject of the tax, the measure of the tax, and a statement of liability. Now, that statement of liability is the most important to we the people because it tells us, it tells the individual human who is, if or if not, they are liable for the tax, aka subject to the tax. All right, so the Constitution talks about taxation, and it has two types of taxes, which are the direct and the indirect. And the Supreme Court, I believe it was, I can't think of his name right now, but anyway, one of the Supreme Court justices said these are the two great classes of taxation. There are no others. It is direct and indirect. And for ease of mental use, we like to refer to the indirect one as an excise, because direct is done by apportionment and it is done on people and property. Indirect or excise is done upon activities. And there is nothing else in the universe that anybody has been able to discover beyond the people, property, or activities classifications. And if you want to if you come up with one of those, I would really like to do it, to send a message to Michael for that. So the Constitution, that the parts of the Constitution that for the United States that refer to these taxes are found first, Article 1, Section 2, Clause 3. Representatives and direct taxes shall be apportioned among the several states which may be included within the Union according to their representative numbers, end quote. So that's why we have a census every 10 years, so we can know how many representatives to put in the House of Representatives in D.C. And if there were any more direct taxes on people, which there haven't been in over 100 years, then they would know how much they could charge. So Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1, quote, the Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises, to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. But all duties, imposts, and excises shall be uniform throughout the United States. So here again, those three things, duties, imposts, and excises, are all indirect taxes, but excise fits the bill as a general title. Article 1, Section 9, Clause 4. No capitation, which is a head tax, or other direct tax, shall be laid unless in proportion to the census or enumeration herein before directed to be taken. Here again, every 10 years we get a census so that all those things balance out. So the Article 1, Section 9, Clause 5 says no tax or duty shall be laid upon articles exported from any state. In other words, you can only lay taxes on imports, and we talked about that earlier, where there was a $10 tax on the head of each Negro coming in from outside the country. So, to reiterate, there are three categories of taxables. They are people, property, and activities. Direct taxes are applied upon people and property via census, enumeration, and valuation. So we've already covered the census and enumeration. The valuation is on, typically you see this when you get your county tax bill for your property at the around October of the year, and it's done by what's called a millage rate. So we'll say that your lot with a house sitting upon it is valued at $100,000. That's what's valued in the marketplace, and then they apply a millage rate. A mill is 1/1000th of a dollar, and so you apply that, and we'll say it's 7%. So, or excuse me, 7 mils. And so, in our example, that would be what, $70 for a tax on $100,000 property, which is pretty good from what I've heard. Nonetheless, that takes care of the direct taxes on people and property. So we have excise taxes on activities. Okay, so the subject of the excise tax must be an activity. However, they have to figure out a way to measure that. So they've come down through time, and there's two ways they figured out. So they can hire somebody to count how many times you do something, or they can put a flat fee on the production capability of whatever this thing is that is producing. So here's a question. Is there an excise tax on whiskey? Well, since whiskey is property, then no. It can't have an excise tax because excise taxes are only on activities. However, you always hear that. There is a tax on whiskey. That's because they have figured out that the process of distillation, which is an activity and declared to be privileged by the powers that be, produces something. So they say that excise tax is on the whiskey, but it is actually the measure of the activity of distillation. So the subject of the tax is the privileged activity of distillation, with the measure being the whiskey itself in containers, whether they be bottles, jugs, or boxes. And you will note, if you ever happen to purchase any of those, that each of them bears a stamp of some type to show that tax has been paid on that distillery. Or, of course, they can put just a flat fee on the capacity of the distillery. So that brings us down, since we're talking about taxes here, to the 16th Amendment. And you probably heard some of these words earlier in the Constitution. Quote, the Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes on incomes from whatever source derived, without apportionment among the several states, and without regard to any census enumeration. Okay, so we've got two great classes of taxation, direct and excise. Even though it says it's on incomes and from whatever source derived, it is without apportionment. Well, if it's not apportionment, it can't be direct, because all direct taxes must be done by apportionment and without regard to any census enumeration. Again, that's part of a direct tax. So this tax that the Congress was given power to lay was an excise tax, but income is not an activity. So what did they do? Well, they placed in 1909 the first post-16th Amendment. Actually, it was only 3 weeks after the 16th Amendment had been had been passed by Congress and sent out for ratification. They passed the 1909 Revenue Act, and that came with it, and it says there is an excise tax upon, in this paraphrasing, there is an excise tax upon income with respect to doing business in the corporate capacity. Well, it says it's on income, but it's obviously an excise tax because it said it in there in the legislation. So that's not that the income cannot be the subject of the tax. It is the with respect to line that gets the subject, which is doing business in the corporate capacity, and then the measured by the income. And the second big case that this particular piece of legislation arrived at the Supreme Court was Stratton Independence v. Halbert. Now, Stratton Independence was a mining operation. So from that case at 415, we see, quote, and however the operation shall be described, the transaction is indubitably business within the fair meaning of the Act of 1909, and the gains derived from it are properly and strictly income from that business. For income may be defined as gain derived from capital, from labor, or from both combined. And here we have the combined operations of capital and labor. As to the alleged inequity of operation between mining corporations and others, it is, of course, a true that the revenues derived from the working of mines resulted to some extent in the exhaustion of the capital. But the same is true of earnings of the human brain and hand when unaided by capital. Pause there. So this is a great explanation of the operation, whether it be by a bunch of people using money and their labor in a corporate thing, or the individual, his individual hand being pushed by the brain, obviously. So to return, so it may be said of many manufacturing corporations that are clearly subject to the Act of 1909, especially of those that have to do with production of patented articles, although it may be foretold from the beginning that the manufacturer will be profitable only for a limited time, at the end of which the capital value of the plant must be subject to the material depletion, and the annual gains of such corporations are certainly to be taken as income for the purposes of measuring the amount of tax. So the Supreme Court laid it out right there. Income is the measure of the tax. What is the subject? Doing business in corporate capacity. And it still is, and I'll go on and prove that in just a few minutes. So back to Stratton B. Howard at 417, quote, and the returns was to be made under oath by the president and treasurer or other officers having like duties, indicating in the clearest manner that it was to set forth data that with the proper accounting would appear upon the books of the corporation. Again, that was from Stratton Independence B. Howard, 1913. So Congress laid it out that the tax on incomes is an excise. Income is the measure on a particular privilege. And we'll go back here to Flint v. Stone Tracy, the first case to come before the court after the 1909 Act for more verification. So from Flint at page 151, quote, the tax under consideration as we have construed the statute may be described as an excise upon the particular privilege of doing business in a corporate capacity, i.e., with the advantages which arise from corporate or quasi-corporate organizations, or when applied to insurance companies, remember that, for doing business of such companies. And we jump to 152 and it says, quote, if business is not done in the manner described in the statute, no tax is payable, end quote. So then we jump down to 161 and we find, quote, in the case at bar, we have already discussed the limitations which the Constitution imposes upon the right to levy excise taxes. Remember all those things in the Constitution about taxes? Quote, and it could not be said, even if the principles of the 14th Amendment were applicable to the present case, that there is no substantial difference between the carrying on of business by the corporation tax and the same business when conducted by a private firm or individual. The thing taxed is not the mere dealing in merchandise, in which the actual transaction may be the same whether conducted by individuals or corporations, but the tax is laid upon the privileges which exist in conducting the business with the advantages which inhere to the corporate capacity of those taxed and which are not enjoyed by private firms, partnerships, or individuals. So all of that being said, we come down to section 701 of the Internal Revenue Code today, which the Internal Revenue Code consists of Title 26, United States Code, as well as Title 26 of the Code of Federal Regulations. So at 701, quote, a partnership as such shall not be subject to the income tax imposed in this chapter, period. All right? So now this is Chapter 1, and guess what it's labeled? The normal taxes and surtaxes. And if you want to go back and read the 1913 law, because of Flint v. Stone Tracy, Flint v. Stone Tracy and Halbert settled the question. It is an excise tax, and an excise tax is upon an activity, which in this case is corporate capacity. So the lexicos got to use shorthand when they wrote it out in the 1913 law, and it says there is hereby a tax on income, and they got to leave off excise, and they get to leave off the witchcraft too, because it was settled by the court. Nicky buggers. So the second sentence of section 701 says exactly that in lexico language. It says, quote, persons carrying on business as partners shall be liable for income tax only in their separate and individual capacities. So there we see exactly what it said back in 1909. The subject is carrying on business because that's the activity of the excise, and they are liable for the income tax. So it says it. It says it right there. Of course, it says it in a way that 99.999% of the Americans have no idea what they're talking about. So, you know, this is just what they do, all right? So all of this falls under what's called the rules of construction. I believe it's Rogers' rule of construction, if I'm not mistaken. And there are several things that you have to abide for when the lexicos or legislative draftmen craft these things to be written into law. And one of them is, probably one of the premier ones is, when you put a definition within the legislation of a word or phrase, it becomes a term, a defined term. And that defined term definition is the only thing you can use when reading that legislation. So they have to tell us what these are, but they don't have to tell us closely to where they use it. So we just read Section 701, and definitions for things like person and partnership are found way over in 7701, which is roughly 2 million words later. And the definition 7701 says at A, when used in this title, where not otherwise distinctly expressed or manifestly incompatible with the intent thereof, one, person, the term person shall be construed to mean and include an individual, a trust, estate, partnership, association, company, or corporation. Now we look, let's look at that little word individual. Individual what? Could it be the individual officer of a corporation? We may find that out. So at section 2, A2, we see the term partnership, which in part reads, the term partnership includes an unincorporated organization. And just as a teaser, I'll tell you that when you go to get a limited liability company built, and you send it into the various secretaries of state of those several states, you will get back a certificate of organization. So partnership, so the limited liability company falls under the term partnership. And so we can go back to 701 and read, the LLC as such shall not be subject to income tax imposed in this chapter. Shabam. So continuing on, everybody out there that thought they were an employee, I want you to look at 7701A20, employee, which is, so this starts out, you'll love this. Quote, for the purposes of applying the previous provisions, of Section 79 with respect to group term life insurance, purchase of employment, for 109 words, we get down to the meat of it, and it says the term employee shall include a full-time life insurance salesman who is considered an employee for the purposes of Chapter 21. So, you know, if you're not a full-time life insurance salesman, according to this definition, you're not an employee. So what are you? So, Chapter 21, by the way, that's where we find FICA. FICA is the Federal Insurance Contribution Act. Now, FICA was first, the pieces of FICA were first brought together in the 1935 Social Security Act. So it was done in 11 separate titles. Now, why was it done that way? Because FDR, who we'll use as a point man on this thing, FDR knew full well that this whole act was unconstitutional. But they figured if they put it in separate titles, if one of the titles fell, the others would stand and they'd get a little bit of their what they wanted, if not all of it. So in Title II, and here again, this is something, if you really want to see a great manifestation of how these word salads work, read the original language of the 1935 Social Security Act. Title I was old age assistance for the states. Title II was federal old age benefits. See difference? Benefits, assistance. And old age benefits and old age reserve account. And which it says at Section 201A, there is hereby created an account in the Treasury of the United States to be known as the Old Age Reserve Account, hereinafter in this title called the account. And it continues on from there. Now, that word reserve is another word for escrow. So they're building an escrow account. And what that it all boils down to, again, I suggest you read this, but it all boils down to that it is a slush fund, and it is for the benefit of some qualified individual, and it has a list of what that is. But it is that account in the Treasury of the United States is it's each individual account for each individual Social Security account number, and they put that all together and it's funded by the Secretary of Treasury at his discretion. It's a slush fund. And I can provide you with a place to go and look where you can put your it's a device that, or an application that allows you to put your Social Security number and see how many people are invested in that account. And it's usually from Western Europe, but there's all places from all over the world. So that's where the account was created. That's where the benefits, the old age benefits, are written out and who gets them and how much and so forth and so on. All right. But the tax that everybody has been told, the FICA tax, where it goes and pays for your Social Security, it's not there. It's over in Title 8. And it says Title 8 taxes with respect to employment, income taxes on employees, Section 801, in addition to other taxes, as in the first income tax post-16th Amendment in 1909, in addition to other taxes, there shall be levied, collected, and paid upon the income of every individual a tax equal to the following percentages of wages received by him after December 31st, 1936, with respect to employment. There's that little phrase again. So we jump down to the 1935 Revenue Act, done in the same year. Subtitle B, General Provisions, Rates of Taxation, Normal Tax on Individuals. Okay? There shall be levied, collected, and paid for each taxable year upon the net income of every individual a normal tax of 4%. Per annum of the amount of net income in excess of the credits against the net income provided in Section 25. Okay. So net income is something you hear all the time. Well, what is income? Income is revenue minus deductions. And that's why they put the net there. But they say it's upon the net income, right? No, the net income is the measure. And if you go back to the 1913 law, that excise tax that they put in there, it was an excise tax upon income. And there's no mention of that. But that's where they described it as the normal tax was in 1913. So to jump down a little farther, just to show you how they progressed this income tax, which, by the way, is the second plank of the Communist Manifesto. At Section 12, it says, surtax on individuals, definitions of surtax income. As used in this surtax, surtax net income means the amount of net income in excess of the credits against the net income provided in Section 25B. And then we jump down earlier, so it was 4%. And then we jump down to the lower section is a B, and it says, at $286,000 upon surtax net incomes of $500,000. So upon the surtax net income in excess of $500,000 and not to exceed $750,000, which is 70%. So in the 1935 law, if you made between half a million and three quarters of $1 million, you paid 70% of that back to the government. How's them apples? So here we have the benefit in Title II, the tax. Oh, by the way, it doesn't go into Social Security. What it goes into is the general fund of the United States. And then the payments to the qualified individuals are done via appropriations from the Congress through the Social Security Administration out of the general fund. That whole thing about, you know, you're paying an insurance policy, and that's a big lie. Earlier we said with respect or includes, you know, we've seen includes and stuff a lot. So, and earlier we said that in today's code, you're the employee is the full-time life insurance salesman. So in 1935 Social Security Act at Section 1101 in Title 11, Section 1101A6, it says the term employee includes an officer of a corporation. Oh, well, that's cool. That's the janitors and the clerks and the machine operators and the secretaries and all that, right? No, because they redefined includes and including. In section 1101B, it says the terms includes and including, when used in a definition contained in this act, shall not be deemed to exclude other things otherwise within the meaning of the term defined, end quote. Well, that comes down to today in section 7701C, and it says includes and including. The terms includes and including, when used in a definition contained in this title, shall not be deemed to exclude other things otherwise within the term of the meaning defined. Well, gee, what does that mean? That means there are, if you do a diagram of those things, it comes up with about three sets of double negatives. Double negative is a positive, so we take those out. And when we take them out, we come up with a much clearer definition, and it says the terms includes and including, when used in a definition contained here, shall be deemed to encompass only the things listed in the term defined. Now, that sounds better, right? So whatever's on the list, as in earlier we read the list of person, which includes individuals, corporations, and so on. See, it's only that. And the United States is the District of Columbia. So now that goes back into showing you that the United States of America, a union of several states, is not in the United States. Makes sense? Thought you'd say so. So, all that being said, how does our company use this to protect your stuff? So what we do is, first of all, we contract with the client for a particular name of a limited liability company. And then we take, by the way, limited liability companies were legislated in 1977. They're the best parts of corporations and partnerships, and they changed the language. So when you have a corporation, the corporation is owned by shareholders and having a number of shares. The offices of a corporation are president, secretary, CEO, and so forth and so on. There's a whole bunch of them. So then you have partnerships, which the traditional statutory partnership have two officers, which are partners, general partners and limited partners. And again, the owners have percentages of ownership. So they combine these, and in the limited liability company, the only officer is a manager, and you can have as many words in front of it like chief executive or whatever, but the only officer is a manager. However, the company can have as many managers as it wishes, and then it's owned by members with percentages of membership, but you can take that down to 4 or 5 decimal points and have as many individual members as you wish as well. So that's what a limited liability company is now and how it works. So our people, we contract with the client for a name, and then we go down to New Mexico. Now, why did we go to New Mexico? Well, I'm fixing to tell you. So one of our parties in our company applies for a limited liability company with the contracted name or as close to it as we can get. And then we submit the articles of organization to the Secretary of State of New Mexico. Now, these articles of organization, which is the application, requires a minimum of two parties on it. They are the organizer and the registered agent. Now, the great thing about New Mexico is that both of those can be other LLCs. So our company has two separate LLCs. One acts as the organizer, which is headquartered in Alamogordo, New Mexico. The other acts as the registered agent, which is headquartered in Raton, New Mexico, all the way at the other end of the state. Now, the organizer and the registered agent, both of those are owned by other LLCs and so on and so forth. So a thinking person can look at that and go, well, wow, that provides a great deal of privacy, because unlike, they say, Delaware, Nevada, or Wyoming, where when you apply for to be incorporated or organized there, you have to have a list of people, and that's known as the nominee list, in the records of those states. And so the list is there. Now, they protect it very well, but in New Mexico, it doesn't exist, and you can't find something that doesn't exist. So with the certificate of organization, Another one of our workers who has never filed a 1040 U.S. individual income tax return and is therefore without the jurisdiction of the IRS goes to the IRS website and files for a tax identification number. Now, this is known as an employer identification number for the company, or EIN. Now, there's five choices when doing this. I won't go into them all, except because we always choose the middle one, and it says for banking purposes. Now, this is what it says in the subheading. Select this option if the reason for applying for the EIN is strictly to satisfy banking requirements or other local laws. Did you hear anything about taxation in there? No, because they know that Section 701 is the truth. So upon receiving the EIN, the person that does that application is then known as the sole member for this new company or this new LLC. That sole member holds a meeting of the company, and in the meeting they make a resolution commissioning a third party as a manager of the LLC. Now, the manager is the only officer, as I said before, of the LLC. So this manager then takes those three pieces of paper, which are the certificate of organization, the EIN paper, and his commission, otherwise known as a letter of authority, down to a bank and gets the new company a checking account. Comes with a debit card, and usually that debit card only has the company name on it and a title. It doesn't have a person's name on it. And then it comes with a debit card. It comes with checks, electronic banking, you know, all the bells and whistles of a standard checking account today. And then that manager brings all this back to the office. And one of our other staffers puts it all together with a pay-as-you-go cell phone. Okay, so pay-as-you-go means it's cash. It's not connected by any kind of contract or anything. Here again, we are doing all of this for the client's privacy and anonymity. So we program up the cell phone. We also like to add Square App and Cash App. A Square App is a point of sale, which it also provides for, you can get another checking account for the new LLC. And Cash App is a peer-to-peer transfer platform, which, again, you can get a third checking account for this new company. So then we box it all up, and we ship it to the client, and literally they open the box up, and they can now are equipped to carry on business worldwide and income tax free. And nobody knows who's doing it. What are your questions?
Just takes me half a second to unmute. Press star two on your press star two on your keypad, ladies and gentlemen. Press star two. This is possibly one of the least expensive ways to come into a working relationship with someone and not have a tax liability associated with it. Yeah, you got something up front to deal with, and that's okay, because it's not very much when you consider what you're saving in even the first year or two. So depending on how much you're making, your first year you could cover your cost to this effect and at the same time be sitting pretty for the rest of your tenure with that person. Sam is the first person with his hand up. Go ahead, Sam.
Oh crap! No, actually, I think I hit star two. Yeah, I think I hit star two. No, you guys go ahead. I'm listening.
Okay.
Oh,
Sam.
Come on, Sam.
Well, I'm interested.
I love it.
I'm interested. Yeah, I'm a newbie. I actually just got my authenticated birth certificate back from California. Now it's got to go to the U.S. Secretary of State. I'm going through a DTSS. So I'm new. I'm learning about the law and everything right now. My buddy Mike, the iron worker, put me on to you guys. So I'm really interested in how to structure my business and myself and remaining tax-free. My freedom is my biggest interest. The not paying taxes is just like kind of a side thing. So I'm really interested in how to structure I'm really interested in how to structure my business and stuff, and I kind of, because I was busy with three other things, I kind of missed part of what you were talking about with getting the Square and the Cash App and then being able to conduct business worldwide.
Well, that all, yeah, that's all part of the package.
Right.
We do everything. Huh?
You guys do everything. Okay. Okay.
You do everything, and you literally open the box and crank it up. We build you this cool spaceship, and then how fast it goes and how far it goes is entirely up to you.
Yeah, I'm a big dreamer, and I definitely sunk my. This all started with $1,000 taken out of one paycheck when me and Mike were doing a refinery together. My first paycheck had $1,000 just in federal out. That wasn't even FICA and state. That was just federal. And I said, this has to change.
He said, you got a light bulb turn on.
It did. So, at some point in this conversation, I kind of have a crisis going, and I'd like to get some advice if I could.
We don't get advice.
I'll make it short. I swear I'll make it short. Does it have to pertain to what we're?
No, go for it. Mr. Slevin is absolutely correct. You will find no advice here whatsoever. Just what we'll share with you, what we would do if we're similarly situated. And before you get into your story, you mentioned another company that you are correcting your status through.
Yeah.
Okay. Just to, as an FYI. GW had the privilege, blessing to be able to look at two other companies on the internet that offer, quote, correcting their status, end quote. And he was able to get the whole package for each one of them forwarded to him so he could review it.
Yeah.
And there was some fatal stuff inside of each of those packages. One package even was requiring you to expatriate, which is the dumbest thing in the world because all of your rights are incorporated in your patriation as a union state citizen or American national. So I'm just saying that be very cautious of what you've got. If you have a finished program that you can send, I will forward it to GW for his review just so that you know what you're into, okay?
Yeah.
If I might say, too, that authentication of the birth certificate is a red herring that buys you nothing.
Right. It's just part of the status correction, right?
No, it's a red herring. It buys you nothing.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, really.
I'll get your guys' email from Mike, I guess. Mike, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
No, Mike, my iron worker buddy, Mike. Okay, so, yeah, I'll get someone's email because if I'm not going to get the full package out of the program I'm in, then I need to switch because, I mean, I'm in this to the tune of $8,000, $465 a month.
Oh, my gosh.
And that's only with $6,100 of debt going to the debt of the U.S. Treasury. So if I need to jump ship, I mean, and take what I have completed at this point, which really it's just at this point I've done a power of attorney with them, and done
no P of A.
Yeah, it's all bogus.
No power of attorney.
You
no. Yeah, give me power of attorney over you. I'll have some fun.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm not laughing.
Sorry,
We're not laughing at you. We're not laughing at
yeah,
you.
Yeah, I'm not. You got to do a little bit of laughing because otherwise you just start crying. But
Yeah. I mean, this is like my life's work doing this. I mean, as soon as I found out about it, I knew that this was going to be my legacy. This was the reason that I freedom. Life is nothing without freedom. And I've known for a long time that I was a slave. I could feel it. I knew it. I have a real heart for justice. I look at the world and I get upset because of the injustice I see. And I'm like, why is it, you know, why? And it's always bothered me. When I saw my opportunity to get off the plantation and to declare myself and to be the sole owner, possessor, a free man, a truly free man, it's the best thing that's ever happened to me, short of one of my kids being born. But I don't want to go because I'm on my laptop a couple hours a day. I'm reading literature. I'm going back and forth to FedEx, to the post office, notarizing things, sending things out, downloading things onto the website. Like I got to download my authenticated birth certificate on the website. So yeah, I'll get you guys' info. It's DTSS, Debt to Success, and I did the Complete Freedom Program. It's like 56 weeks. I'll get a passport. I'll have a trust set up. I'll get a new passport. I'll get a trust set up. I'll revoke my Social Security and my driver's license. They set up the trust.
Okay.
Sam,
I just sent you a text. Would you check your phone, please, to see that you have it before we continue?
Yeah, I got it.
Okay. All right. Yeah, I lied. All right, so we go from there. Any questions that you want to ask at this time while you've got us on the phone?
I do.
My
21-year-old daughter, my 17-year-old son, 17-and-a-half-year-old son in Kansas ran away from his mom's house, went to his sister's house, and sis put him up. Cops came by. Is he here? Nope, he's not here. They leave. They come back the next day. She's not on probation or parole, but she does have a CPS case pending. Cops come back the next night. Is he here? No. They come back the next night. Is he here? And that time, his girlfriend was there in the door. Long story short, Gavin, my son is there, and the cops are like, all right, come on. So my daughter's been missing for like 3 weeks. December 14th, she disappeared off Facebook. I knew she was in jail. I figured it was for something minor and stupid. So I call. I find her. She's in jail with felony kidnapping charge, a felony aggravated assault that she knows nothing about, and a felony harboring a runaway for her sibling come to her house. So my question is, can she, even though her status isn't corrected, can she stand as a free American national in that court and utilize the law as we know it to protect herself?
Kind of, sort of, but it's like waving an unloaded gun. And correcting your status is, in other words, you can scare a hell of a lot of people with a gun in your hand. But the point is that there are things that you can go through. If this was just being approached to me by anybody, I'd say the first thing that you need to do is to correct your status. It's going to be $5,000. And the next thing you need to do is to bring the team aboard, and that's $20,000. You're looking at $25,000 to do what needs to get done. I see that you've been on the call for 54 minutes, so you missed the announcement at the beginning of this call. We had a gentleman that 4 months ago, something like that, began and his corrective status problem process. And he was returning from California where he purchased, I call them gummy bears, or the SBD chewables, whatever it is.
I caught that the other day, that story you were talking about the other day. I was on the call. Go ahead.
Well, guess what?
What?
Earlier this week, he got a check for $5,000 in the mail, which was the $5,000 they confiscated from him on the side of the road. And today he received in the mail a filing into the court by the prosecutor asking the judge, saying that the state is dropping all charges against the student.
Okay, good.
So now we're just waiting for the court order.
Okay.
So the point of what I'm saying is your power and authority is in that status correction.
Right. So I'm just going to go with a normal attorney for it because it should be a slam dunk. They have – like my friend Mike said, you know, when she goes to court on the 19th, have them tell her to ask to see the evidence against her, sworn statements, affidavits, and he said
Mike from Las Vegas.
Yeah, from Las Vegas, and he said,
okay, he's here.
He said, oh, he is. Okay, yeah, he said, tell him to make sure that he said to make call the county attorney, get there, ask them if they're bonded. If they are, get the name of the bonding company, get the address of the bonding company, and get the amount that they're bonded for. He said that the judge has to have a current bar card and just like the things to make sure that the court she's in is a legitimate court and that, that everybody's got their T's right. crossed, their I's dotted. Because they, my daughter's 20 years old. She's
Mike,
a baby.
You said that Mike said that to hire an attorney?
No, Mike didn't tell me to hire the attorney. Mike
oh, okay,
said,
good, because that would be shocking for to hear that Michael said that.
No, Mike didn't. No, but the thing is that we've got a slave citizen person in the de facto corporate system, and I don't really know what to do about that other than just hire an attorney and play their game.
Well, that's exactly what you do when you hire the attorney. You are playing their game, and it's their rules, and that you have three members of the bar, the judge, the prosecutor, and the defending attorney, all members of the bar, and a little lamb deciding what's going to be on the menu for lunch. No, it's not good. Call me sometime tomorrow. You've got my phone number. Call me sometime.
I got to throw one more thing in. When her brother, 17 and a half, he hasn't seen me since he was two. Both of their moms kept my kids. I lost my parental rights to my girls. I've been clean and sober for 16 years. They didn't see me for that whole time because there was just animosity, bitterness, and I was written off. Yeah. And they worked double time to keep me out of the picture, even though I've grown and I'm, like, solid, you know, clean 16 years, 12 sober.
Yeah.
Haven't smoked a cigarette in 10. I'm a good guy. I work really hard. I'm a union crane operator, and I'm very well squared away. So my 17-year-old kid was acting out because he's never been around me. I know his story because I lived his story. So when the mom didn't want him back. He's 17 and a half. He goes to sister. Cops hand him up there. Take him, put him in foster care. Mom says, I don't want him. I called the state. And I tell them, that's my son, I'm his biological father, and I could pass any drug test, I can prove that I'm well structured and everything's solid here. If his mom doesn't want him, he's more than welcome to come stay with me. They never returned my call, and they just put him in a foster placement instead.
Sometime tomorrow afternoon, late afternoon, early evening. Give me a call, please. You've got my phone number. I texted it to you.
Okay.
I want to get you in front of the team leader, John, and just have him see what he can say to you. Okay.
I don't want to take up your guys' whole call. I realize this is a dumpster fire, so I'll let you guys get back to business, and I'll just listen.
Well, we're glad that you joined us tonight, and I'm sorry for your troubles that you're going through at the moment. And congratulations
The worst part is you guys bummed me out about my status correction. Now I'm like, shit, what do I do? I want to talk to you tomorrow about making sure that I'm in the right program.
Yeah. All right. So give me a call tomorrow, late afternoon, early evening, and we'll put some things in order for you. Anyone else press star here and you keep that. Otherwise, we're going to say goodnight. We're running a little bit late in overtime. Otherwise, we're going to ask Mr. Slevin for any closing comments. Whoa, here comes Mike from Lost Wages. Go ahead, Mike. Wait a minute, what happened here? I think I still have him muted. There we go. Go ahead.
He's in California, so you need to reiterate the three-hour time difference.
Whoa, yeah. So let me just see if he's still here. Where'd he go? There's Sam. Sam, I just unmuted your phone. Yeah, that's when I say late afternoon, early evening, I'm talking my time, 3 hours ahead of you. So call me sometime after 2 o'clock, and it must be before 6 because I have a call that starts at 6 o'clock your time.
Yeah, definitely. Okay. I think comes up. Oh, I thought you were in Seattle. Sorry.
No.
Okay. Sorry about that.
386 area code. I'm here in Florida.
Oh, okay. Where does that say Seattle? Yeah, it says Seattle, Washington, 206-402-0100. But that's not the number I dialed.
No, that number is – no, that's the conference call number. That's not my number. And don't say it aloud on the phone. I text you my phone number.
Okay. All right.
All right. Anyone that needs to reach me, my public number is 800-625-4250. 800-625-4250. Okay. Michael, did you have any other comments aside from that?
No, I just keep giving people information. This last job at the GM plant in Lansing, Michigan, I got about 20 guys now plumbed up and lined out, so they should start listening in, and hopefully they get,
great.
You know. Anyway, you're welcome. I'm working long hours, so I'm in bed, and I'm fixing to turn out the light and go to sleep.
All righty.
Sleep
all
right. Well.
I want to thank Mr. Slevin. Any closing comments, sir?
Have a bodacious good year.
Bodacious. I haven't heard that since, who was it? Hank Williams Sr. named his son Bocephus.
Bodacious.
Yeah. All right. Thank you all for joining us this evening. Come back again this Saturday and learn how to own nothing but control everything. That will be Justice Beshear's call on asset protection. Until then, good night, everyone. And be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.